stretched his hand out and said, "Like divine Shara am I, the beloved son of Inanna." But the guardian of the sacred place turned Lugalbanda down with an oracle. Indeed, he would reach far lands and make both himself and Erech famous, but he would do so on foot. Another long epic tale, originally called by scholars Lugalbanda and Enmerkar, and more recently the Lugalbanda epic, affirms Lugalbanda's semi-divine descent, but does not identify his father. We can assume, however, from the circumstances and subsequent events, that the father was Enmerkar. Confirming Enmerkar as the first one in a long list of rulers, who under the guise of a symbolic marriage, or without it, were invited by Inanna to share her bed. This invitation by Inanna is featured in the well-known Epic of Gilgamesh, the fifth ruler of Erech. Gilgamesh sought to escape the mortal's destiny to die, because, as a son of the goddess Ninsun and the high priest of the Kulub, two-thirds of him were god. In his search for immortality, he first journeyed to the landing place in the Cedar Mountain, the olden landing platform in the mountains of Lebanon, to which apparently Lugalbanda had also gone. Battling the mechanical monster that guarded the restricted area's perimeter, Gilgamesh and his companion were almost annihilated, were it not for Utu's help. Exhausted from the battle, Gilgamesh took off his drenched clothes so that he might wash and rest. It was then that Inanna Ishtar, who watched the struggle from the skies, was seized with a craving for Gilgamesh. He washed his grimy hair, polished his weapons. The braid of his hair he shook out against his back. He cast off his soiled things, put on his clean ones, wrapped a fringed cloak about, fastened with a sash. When Gilgamesh put on his tiara, glorious Ishtar raised an eye at the beauty of Gilgamesh. "Come, Gilgamesh, be thou my lover," she said. "Do grant me of thy fruitfulness. Thou shalt be a husband, I shall be a wife." She reinforced her invitation with promises of a glorious, though not everlasting, life, if Gilgamesh would accede to her offer. But Gilgamesh retorted with a long list of her lovers, whom she befriended, though she had ordained for Tammuz, Dumuzi, the lover of her youth, wailing year after year. While still supposedly in mourning, he said, she acquired and discarded lovers, as a shoe which pinches the foot of its owner, as a door which does not keep out the wind. "Which lover didst thou love forever?" he asked. "If thou shouldst make love to me, thou wouldst treat me like them." The offended Inanna thereupon received Anu's permission to launch against Gilgamesh the Bull of Heaven. Gilgamesh was saved from it at the last moment at the gates of Erech. The golden era of Erech was not to last forever. Seven other kings followed Gilgamesh on its throne. Then Uruk was smitten with weapons. Its kingship to Ur was carried. Thorkild Jacobson, whose study the Sumerian king list is the most thorough on the subject, believes that the transfer of kingship in Sumer from Erech to Ur occurred circa 2850 BC. Others adopt a lower date of circa 2650 BC. Such a discrepancy of two centuries has persisted into later times and remains unexplained by scholars. The reigns of the various rulers were getting shorter and shorter as the site of kingship swung back and forth among Sumer's principal cities, from Ur to Awan, then back to Kish, to a city named Hamazi, then back to Erech and Ur and Adab and Mari, and back to Kish, to Aksak, and again to Kish, and finally once more to Erech. In the course of no more than 220 years, there were thus three additional dynasties at Kish, three at Erech, two at Ur, and single ones in five other cities. It was, by all appearances, a volatile period. It was also a time of increasing friction between the cities, mostly over water rights and irrigation canals, phenomena that can be explained by drier weather on the one hand and rising populations on the other. In each instance, the town that lost out was said to have been smitten with weapons. Mankind had begun to wage its own wars. The resort to arms to settle local disputes was becoming more commonplace. Inscriptions from those days indicate that the harassed populace was competing, through offerings and enhanced worship, for the favors of the gods, the warring city-states increasingly involved their patron gods in their petty disputes. In one recorded instance, Ninurta was involved in determining whether an irrigation ditch encroached on another city's boundaries. Enlil, too, was forced to order the warring parties to disengage. This constant strife and lack of stability soon reached a point when the gods had had enough. Once before, when the deluge was coming, Enlil was so disgusted with mankind that he schemed its obliteration by the great flood. Then, in the Tower of Babel incident, he ordered mankind's dispersion and the confusion of its languages. Now again, he was growing disgusted. The historical background to the events that followed was the final attempt by the gods to re-establish Kish, the original capital, as the center of kingship. For the fourth time, they returned kingship to Kish, starting the dynasty with rulers whose names indicate fealty to Sin, Ishtar, and Shamash. Two rulers, however, bore names indicating that they were followers of Ninurta and his spouse, evidence of a revived rivalry between the House of Sin and the House of Ninurta. It resulted in the seating on the throne of a non-entity, Nania, a stonecutter. He reigned a brief 7 years. In such unsettled circumstances, Inanna was able to retrieve the kingship for Erech. The man chosen for the task, one Lugal Zaghizi, retained the favor of the gods for 25 years, but then, attacking Kish to assure her permanent desolation, he only managed to raise Enlil's ire. And the idea of a strong hand at the helm of human kingship made more and more sense. There was a need for someone uninvolved in all these disputes, someone who would provide firm leadership and once again properly perform the role of the king as sole intermediary between the gods and the people in all matters mundane. It was Inanna who, on one of her flying trips, found that man. Her encounter with him, circa 2400 BC, launched a new era. He was a man who began his career as a cupbearer to the king of Kish. When he took over the state reins in central Mesopotamia, he quickly extended his rule to all of Sumer, to its neighboring countries, and even unto distant lands. The epithet name of this first empire builder was Shahrukin, righteous ruler. Modern textbooks call him Sargon the First, or Sargon the Great, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 80. He built himself a brand new capital not far from Babylon and named it Agada, United. We know it as Akkad, a name from which stems the term Akkadian for the first Semitic language. A text known as the Legend of Sargon records in Sargon's own words his odd personal history. Sargon, the mighty king of Agada, am I. My mother was a high priestess. I knew not my father. My mother, the high priestess who conceived me, in secret she bore me. She set me in a basket of rushes, with bitumen sealed the lid. She cast me into the river. It did not sink me. The river bore me up. It carried me to Aki, the irrigator. Aki, the irrigator, lifted me up when he drew water. Aki, the irrigator, as his son made me and reared me. Aki, the irrigator, appointed me as his gardener. This Moses-like tale, written more than 1,000 years before the time of Moses, then continues to answer the obvious question. How could a man of unknown fatherhood, a mere gardener, become a mighty king? Sargon answered the questions thus. While I was a gardener, Ishtar granted me her love, and for 54 years I exercised kingship. The black-headed people I ruled and governed. The laconic statement is elaborated in another text, The encounter between Sargon, the working man, and Ishtar, the lovely goddess, was accidental, but far from innocent. One day my queen, after crossing heaven, crossing earth, Inanna, after crossing heaven, crossing earth, after crossing Elam and Shubur, after crossing... The Erijul approached, weary, fell asleep. I saw her from the edge of my garden, kissed her, copulated with her. Inanna by then awakened, we must assume, found in Sargon a man to her liking, a man who could satisfy not only her bedtime cravings, but also her political ambitions. A text known as the Sargon Chronicle states that Shahrukin, king of Agata, rose to power in the era of Ishtar. He had neither rival nor opponent. He spread his terror-inspiring glamour over all the countries. He crossed the sea in the east. He conquered the country of the west, in its full extent. The enigmatic reference to the era of Ishtar has baffled the scholars. But it can only mean what it says. At that time, for whatever reasons, Inanna Ishtar was able to have a man of her choice take the throne and create for her an empire. He defeated Uruk and tore down its wall. He was victorious in the battle with the inhabitants of Ur. He defeated the entire territory from Lagash as far as the sea. There were also the conquests beyond the olden boundaries of Sumer. Mari and Elam are standing in obedience before Sargon. The grandeur of Sargon and the greatness of Inanna, going hand in hand, were expressed in the construction of the new capital city of Agata, and in it the Ulmash, glittering, luxurious temple to Inanna. In those days, a Sumerian historiographic text relates, the dwellings of Agata were filled with gold, its bright shining houses were filled with silver, into its storehouses were brought copper, lead, and slabs of lapis lazuli. Its granaries bulged at the sides. Its old men were endowed with wisdom. Its old women were endowed with eloquence. Its young men were endowed with the strength of weapons. Its little children were endowed with joyous hearts. The city was full of music. In that beautiful and happy city, in Agata, did holy Inanna erect a temple as her noble abode. In the Ulmash, she set up a throne. It was the crowning temple in a series of shrines to her that encompassed Sumer's principal cities, stating that in Erech, the Inanna is mine. Inanna lists her shrines in Nippur, Gersu, Adab, Kish, Dur, Akshak, and Uma, and lastly the Ulmash in Agata. Is there a god who can vie with me? She asked. Yet, though promoted by Inanna, the elevation of Sargon to kingship over what was henceforth known as Sumer and Akkad could not have taken place without the consent and blessing of Anu and Enlil. A bilingual Sumerian-Akkadian text, originally inscribed on a statue of Sargon that was placed before Enlil in his temple in Nippur, stated that Sargon was not only commanding overseer of Ishtar, but also anointed priest of Anu and great regent of Enlil. It was Enlil, Sargon wrote, who had given him lordship and kingship. Sargon's records of his conquests describe Inanna as actively present on the battlefields, but attribute to Enlil the overall decision regarding the scope of the victories and the extent of the territories. Enlil did not let anybody oppose Sargon, the king of the land. From the upper sea to the lower sea, Enlil gave unto him. Invariably postscripts to Sargon's inscriptions invoked Anu, Enlil, Inanna, and Utu Shamash as his witnesses. As one scrutinizes this vast empire, stretching from the upper sea, Mediterranean, to the lower sea, Persian Gulf, it becomes clear that Sargon's conquests were at first limited to the domains of Sin and his children, Inanna and Utu, and even at their peak kept well within the Enlilite territories. Sargon reached Lagash, the city of Ninurta, and conquered the territory from Lagash southward, but not Lagash itself. nor did he expand to the northeast of Sumer, where Ninurta held sway. Going beyond the boundaries of olden Sumer, he entered to the southeast, the land of Elam, an area under Inanna's influence from earlier times. But when Sargon was entering the lands to the west, on the mid-Euphrates and the Mediterranean coast, the domains of Adad, Sargon prostrated himself in prayer before the god, and he gave him in the upper region Mari, Yarmuli, and Ebla, as far as the cedar forest and the silver mountain. It is clear from Sargon's inscriptions that he was neither given Tilmun, the god's own fourth region, nor Magan, Egypt, nor Malua, Ethiopia, in the second region, the domains of Enki's descendants. With those lands, he only conducted peaceful trading relations. In Sumer itself, he kept out of the area controlled by Ninurta and from the city claimed by Marduk. But then, in his old age, Sargon made a mistake. He took away soil from the foundation of Babylon and built upon the soil another Babylon beside Agada. To understand the severity of this deed, we ought to recall the meaning of Babylon, Bab-Eli, Gateway of the Gods, a title and a function claimed for Babylon by a defiant Marduk. It was symbolized by its hollowed soil. Now encouraged by Inanna and driven by her ambitions, Sargon took away the sacred soil to spread it as a foundation for the new Bab-Eli, audaciously aiming to transfer the title and function to Agada. This was, as it turned out, an opportunity for Marduk, unheard from for so many centuries, to reassert himself. On account of the sacrilege Sargon thus committed, the great lord Marduk became enraged and destroyed his people by hunger. From the east to the west, he alienated them from Sargon, and upon him he inflicted as punishment that he could not rest. Desperately crushing one revolt after another, Sargon could not rest. Discredited and afflicted, he died after a reign of 54 years. Chapter 12. Prelude to Disaster. The information concerning the last years of the era of Ishtar comes to us from a number of texts. Put together, they unfold a tale of dramatic and incredible events: the usurpation of supreme powers on earth by a goddess, the defilement of Enlil's Holy of Holies in Nippur, the penetration of the fourth region by a human army, an invasion of Egypt, the appearance of African gods in the Asian domains, acts and occurrences that were unthinkable before, upheavals among the gods which served as a stage on which human rulers played out their roles and human blood was spilled without mercy. Faced with the reemergence of her olden adversary, Inanna could simply not give up, no matter what the cost. Seating on Sargon's throne first one of his sons, and then another, enlisting in her campaigns her vassal kings in the eastern mountain lands, she fought as an enraged lioness for her disintegrating empire, raining flame over the land, attacking like an aggressive storm. "You were known by your destruction of the rebel lands," intoned a daughter of Sargon, in a plaintive poem. "You were known by massacring their people, turning against the city that said, 'Not the land is yours,' making its rivers run with blood." For more than 2 years Inanna wrought havoc all around, until the gods decided that the only way to stop the carnage was to force Marduk back into exile. Having returned to Babylon when Sargon tried to remove some of its hollowed soil, an act whose symbolism was rooted in legendary events, Marduk fortified the city, and in particular ingeniously enhanced its underground water system, making the city impervious to attack. Unable or unwilling to remove Marduk by force, the Anunnaki turned to Marduk's brother, Nergal, and asked him to scare Marduk off the divine seat in Babylon. We know of these events from a text named by scholars, the Era Epos, for in it Nergal is called by the ancient chronicler Ur-Ra, a somewhat derogatory epithet, for it meant the servant of Ra. It is a text that could better be called the Tale of the Sins of Nergal, for it puts the blame on Nergal for a chain of events with a catastrophic ending. But it is an invaluable source for our knowledge and understanding of that prelude to disaster. Having accepted the mission, Nergal, Ur-Ra, journeyed to Mesopotamia for a face-to-face talk with Marduk. Arriving in Mesopotamia, he first stopped at Erech, the city of Anu, the king of all the gods, but of course also the place to huddle with Inanna Ishtar. Arriving in Babylon, into the Esagil, temple of heaven and earth, he entered, and stood before Marduk. The momentous encounter has been recorded by the ancient artists, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 81. It depicts both gods holding onto their weapons, but the helmeted Marduk, standing on a platform, does extend some symbol of welcome to his brother. Combining praise with reprimand, Ur-Ra told Marduk that the wonderful things he had done for Babylon, and especially its waterworks, made Marduk's reputation shine as a star in the heavens, but have deprived other cities of their waters. Moreover, while crowning himself in Babylon, lights up its sacred precinct, it angered the other gods, the abode of Anu with darkness it covers. Marduk, he concluded, could not go on against the will of the other Anunnaki, and certainly not against the will of Anu. But Marduk, citing changes that were made on earth in the aftermath of the deluge, explained that he had to take matters into his own hands. In the aftermath of the deluge, the decrees of heaven and earth had gone astray. The cities of the gods upon the wide earth were changed around. They were not brought back to their locations. As I survey them again, of the evil I am disgusted. Without a return to their original places, mankind's existence is diminished. Rebuild I must my residence, which in the deluge was wiped away. Its name I must call again. Among the post-diluvian disorders that bothered Marduk were some failures on the part of Ur-Ra himself to account for certain divine artifacts, the instrument of giving orders, the oracle of the gods, the sign of kingship, the holy scepter which contributes brilliance to lordship. Where is the holy radiating stone which disintegrates all? Marduk asked. If he were forced to leave, Marduk said, on the day I step off my seat, the flooding shall from its well cease to work. The waters shall not rise. The bright day to darkness shall turn. Confusion shall arise. The winds of drought shall howl. Sicknesses shall spread. After some more exchanges, Ur-Ra offered to return to Marduk the artifacts of heaven and earth, if Marduk would personally go to the lower world to pick them up. And as to the works in Babylon, he assured Marduk there was nothing to worry about. He, Ur-Ra, would enter Marduk's house only to erect the bulls of Anu and Enlil at thy gate, statues of winged bulls, as were usually found at temple sites, but would do nothing to upset the waterworks. Marduk heard this, the promise given by Ur-Ra, found his favor. So did he step down from his seat, and to the land of mines, abode of the Anunnaki, he set his direction. Thus persuaded, Marduk agreed to leave Babylon, but no sooner had he done that than Nergal broke his word. Unable to resist his curiosity, Nergal, Ur-Ra, ventured into the Gigunu, the mysterious underground chamber, which Marduk had stressed was off-limits, and there Ur-Ra caused its brilliance, radiating source of energy, to be removed. Thereupon, as Marduk had warned, the day turned into darkness, the flooding was disarrayed, and soon the lands were laid to waste, the people were made to perish. All of Mesopotamia was affected, For Ea, Enki, Sin, and Shamash, and their cities, became alarmed. With anger, at Ra, they were filled. The people made sacrifices to Anu and Ishtar, but to no avail. The water sources went dry. Ea, Ra's father, approached him. Now that Prince Marduk had stepped off, what have you done? He ordered that a statue of Ra, which had been prepared, should not be set up in Isagil. Go away, he ordered Ra. Take off to where no gods ever go. Ra lost his voice, only for a moment, then uttered words of impudence. Enraged, he smashed Marduk's abode, set fire to its gates. Defiantly he made a sign, as he turned to leave, announcing that his followers, however, would stay behind. As to my warriors, they shall not go back. And so it was that when Ra returned to Cutha, the men who had come with him stayed behind, establishing a long-lasting presence for Nergal in the lands of Shem. A colony was assigned to them, not far from Babylon, perhaps as a permanent garrison. There were Cuthians who worshipped Nergal in Samaria in biblical times, and there was official worship of Nergal in Elam, as evidenced by an unusual bronze sculpture, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 82, found there, depicting worshippers with unmistakable African features, performing a cultic ceremony in a temple courtyard. The departure of Marduk from Babylon brought to an end Ishtar's conflict with him. The rift between Marduk and Nergal, and the latter's retention of an Asian presence, unintentionally created an alliance between Ishtar and Nergal. The chain of tragic events that no one could have predicted, and that no one had perhaps even desired, was thus being forged by fate, leading the Anunnaki and mankind ever closer to the ultimate disaster. With her authority restored, Inanna renewed the kingship in Agada, and put on the throne a grandson of Sargon, Naram-Sin, Sin's favorite. Seeing in him at last a true successor to Sargon, she encouraged him to seek grandeur and greatness. After a brief period of peace and prosperity, she goaded Naram-Sin to embark on an expansion of the erstwhile empire. Soon Inanna began to encroach on the territories of other gods, but they were unable or unwilling to fight her. The great Anunnaki gods fled before you like fluttering bats, a hymn to Inanna stated. They could not stand before your fearsome face, could not soothe your angry heart. Rock carvings in the annexed territories depicted Inanna as the ruthless conqueror she had become, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 83. At the beginning of her campaigns, Inanna was still called Beloved of Enlil, and one who carries out the instructions of Anu. But then her thrust began to change in nature, from the suppression of rebellions to a calculated plan for seizing supremacy. Two sets of texts, one dealing with the goddess and the other with her surrogate, the king Naram-Sin, record the events of those times. Both indicate that the first out-of-bounds target of Inanna was the landing place in the Cedar Mountain. As a flying goddess, Inanna was quite familiar with the place. She burnt down the great gates of the mountain and, after a brief siege, obtained the surrender of the troops guarding it. They disbanded themselves willingly. As recorded in the Naram-Sin inscriptions, Inanna then turned south along the Mediterranean coast, subduing city after city. The conquest of Jerusalem, Mission Control Center, is not specifically mentioned, but Inanna must have been there too, for it is recorded that she had gone on to capture Jericho. Lying astride the strategic Jordan River crossing, and opposite the Anunnaki stronghold at Tel Gasul, Jericho, the city dedicated to Sin, had also rebelled. It said not, "It belongs to your father who begot you." It had promised its solemn word, but turned away from it. The Old Testament is filled with admonitions against straying after alien gods. The Sumerian text conveys the same transgression. The people of Jericho, having given a solemn promise to worship Sin, Inanna's father, have switched allegiance to another alien god. The surrender of this city of date palms to an armed Inanna was depicted on a cylinder seal, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 84. With the conquest of southern Canaan, Inanna stood at the gateway to the fourth region, the region of the spaceport. Sargon had not dared cross the forbidden line, but Naram-Sin, encouraged by Inanna, did. A Mesopotamian royal chronicle attests that not only did Naram-Sin enter the peninsula, but he had gone on to invade the land of Magan, Egypt. Naram-Sin, offspring of Sargon, marched against the town of Apishal and made a breach in its wall, conquering it. He personally caught Rish-Adad, king of Apishal, and the vizier of Apishal. He then marched against the country of Magan and personally caught Manu-Danu, king of Magan. The accuracy of the above-mentioned Babylonian royal chronicle has been independently confirmed in its other details, so there is no reason to doubt this part of it too, incredible as it sounds, for it entailed the passage of a human king and a human army through the Sinai Peninsula, the god's own fourth region. Since time immemorial, a trade route between Asia and Africa had wound its way along the peninsula's Mediterranean coast, a route later on enhanced by the Egyptians with watering stations and by the Romans as their vital Via Maris. Ancient users of this route thus kept well away from the central plain where the spaceport was located. But whether Naram-Sin, at the head of an army, just marched through along the coastal route is questionable. Alabaster vases of Egyptian design, which have been found by archaeologists in Mesopotamia and Elam, identified their owner, in Akkadian, as Naram-Sin, king of the four regions, vase of the shining crown of the land of Magan. That Naram-Sin began to call himself king of the four regions affirms not only the conquest of Egypt, but also suggests the inclusion of the Sinai Peninsula in his sphere of influence. Inanna, it appears, was more than just passing through. A foreign invasion about the time of Naram-Sin is also known from Egyptian records. They describe a period of disarray and chaos, in the words of the papyrus known to Egyptologists as the admonitions of Ipuwer. Strangers have come into Egypt, high-born or full of lamentation. It was a period that saw the shift of the center of worship and kingship from Memphis, Heliopolis in the north, to Thebes in the south. Scholars call the century of disarray the first intermediate period. It followed the collapse of the sixth Pharaonic dynasty. How could Inanna, with apparent immunity, intrude on the Sinai Peninsula and invade Egypt unopposed by the gods of Egypt? The answer lies in an aspect of the Naram-Sin inscriptions that has baffled the scholars. The apparent veneration by this Mesopotamian ruler of the African god Nergal. Although this made no sense at all, the fact is that the long text known as the Kuthian legend of Naram-Sin attests that Naram-Sin went to Kutha, Nergal's cult center in Africa, and erected there a stela to which he affixed an ivory tablet inscribed with the tale of this unusual visit, all to pay homage to Nergal. The recognition by Naram-Sin of Nergal's power and influence well beyond Africa is attested by the fact that in treaties made between Naram-Sin and provincial rulers in Elam, Nergal is invoked among the witness gods, and in an inscription dealing with Naram-Sin's march to the Cedar Mountain in Lebanon, the king credited Nergal, rather than Ishkur-Adad, with making the achievement possible. Although since the era of the rulership of man, none of the kings has ever destroyed Armon and Ebla. Now did the god Nergal open up the path for the mighty Naram-Sin. He gave him Armon and Ebla, presented him with the Amanus, and with the Cedar Mountain, and with the Upper Sea. This puzzling emergence of Nergal as an influential Asian deity, and the audacious march of Inanna's surrogate Naram-Sin to Egypt, All violations of the status quo of the four regions established after the Pyramid Wars have one explanation. While Marduk had shifted his attention to Babylon, Nergal assumed a preeminent role in Egypt. Then, having gone to persuade Marduk to leave Mesopotamia without further struggle, the amicable parting turned into a bitter enmity between the brothers. And this led to an alliance between Nergal and Inanna. But as they stood for each other, they soon found themselves opposed by all the other gods. An assembly of the gods was held in Nippur to deal with the disruptive consequences of Inanna's exploits. Even Enki agreed that she had gone too far, and a decree for her arrest and trial was issued by Enlil. We learned of these events from a chronicle titled by scholars The Curse of Agata. Deciding that Inanna had indeed gotten out of hand, the word of the Iker, Enlil's sacred precinct in Nippur, was issued against her. But Inanna did not wait to be seized or held for trial. She forsook her temple and escaped from Agata. The word of Iker was upon Agata, like a deathly silence. Agata was all a tremble. Its Olmash temple was in terror. She who lived there left the city. The maiden forsook her chamber. Holy Inanna forsook her shrine in Agata. By the time a delegation of the great gods arrived in Agata, they only found an empty temple. All they could do was strip the place of its attributes of power. In days not five, in days not ten, the crown band of lordship, the tiara of kingship, the throne given to rulership, Ninurta brought over to his temple. Utu carried off the city's eloquence. Enki withdrew its wisdom, its awesomeness that could reach the heaven. Anu brought up to the midst of heaven. The kingship of Agata was prostrated. Its future was extremely unhappy. Then Naram-Sin had a vision, a communication from his goddess Inanna. He kept it to himself, put it not in speech, spoke with nobody about it. 7 years Naram-Sin remained in wait. Did Inanna seek out Nergal during her 7-year disappearance from Agata? The text does not give us the answer, but we believe that it was the only haven available to Inanna, away from Enlil's wrath. The ensuing events suggest that Inanna, even more audacious than before, more ambitious than ever, must have obtained the backing of at least one other major god, and that could have been only Nergal. That Inanna would hide in Nergal's lower African domain seems thus a most plausible assumption. Did the two, talking over the situation, reviewing past events, discussing the future, end up forging a new alliance that could rearrange the divine domains? A new order was indeed feasible, for Inanna was shattering the old divine order upon the earth. A text whose ancient title was Queen of All the Mies acknowledges that Inanna had indeed deliberately decided to defy the authority of Anu and Enlil, abrogated their rules and regulations, and declared herself the supreme deity, a great queen of queens, announcing that she has become greater than the mother who gave birth to her, even greater than Anu. She followed up her declarations with deeds and seized the Iana, house of Anu in Erech, aiming to dismantle this symbol of Anu's authority. The heavenly kingship was seized by a female. She changed altogether the rules of holy Anu, feared not the great Anu. She seized the Iana from Anu, the house of irresistible charm, enduring allure. On that house she brought destruction. Inanna assaults its people, makes them captive. The coup d'etat against Anu was accompanied by a parallel attack on Enlil's seat and symbols of authority. This task was assigned by Inanna to Naram-Sin. His attack on the Iker and Nippur and the resulting downfall of Agata are detailed in the Curse of Agata text. From it, we gather that after the 7-year wait, Naram-Sin received further oracles and thereupon changed his line of action. Upon receiving the new orders, he defied the word of Enlil, crushed those who had served in Lil, mobilized his troops, and like a hero accustomed to high-handedness, put a restraining hand on the Eker. Overrunning the seemingly undefended city, like a bandit, he plundered it. He then approached the Eker in the sacred precinct, erecting large ladders against the house. Smashing his way in, he entered its Holy of Holies. The people now saw its sacred cella, a chamber that knew not light. The Akkadians saw the holy vessels of the god. Naram Sin cast them into the fire. He docked large boats at the quay by the house of Enlil and carried off the possessions of the city. The horrible sacrilege was complete. Enlil, his whereabouts unstated, but clearly away from Nippur, lifted his eyes and saw the destruction of Nippur and the defilement of the Eker. Because his beloved Eker had been attacked, he ordered the hordes of Gutium, a mountain land to the northeast of Mesopotamia, to attack Akkad and lay it waste. They came down upon Akkad and its cities in vast numbers, like locusts. Nothing escaped their arm. He who slept on the roof died on the roof. He who slept inside the house was not brought to burial. Heads were crushed, mouths were crushed. The blood of the treacherous flowed over the blood of the faithful. Once, and then a second time, the other gods interceded with Enlil. "Curse Agada with a baleful curse," they said, "and let the other cities and the farmland survive." When Enlil finally agreed, 8 great gods joined in putting a curse on Agada, the city who dared assault the Eker. "And lo," said the ancient historian, "so it came to pass, Agada is destroyed." The gods decreed that Agada be wiped off the face of the earth. And unlike other cities that, having been destroyed, were rebuilt and resettled, Agada forever remained desolate. As to Inanna, her heart was appeased, finally by her parents. What exactly happened, the texts do not state. They tell us, however, that her father, Nannar, came forth to fetch her back to Sumer, while her mother, Ningal, proffered prayers for her, greeted her back at the temple's doorstep. "Enough, more than enough innovations, O great queen," the gods and the people appealed to her, and the foremost queen in her assembly accepted the prayer. The era of Ishtar was over. All the textual evidence suggests that Enlil and Ninurta were away from Mesopotamia when Naram Sin attacked Nippur. But the hordes that swept down from the mountains upon Akkad were the hordes of Enlil, and they were in all probability guided into the great Mesopotamian plain by Ninurta. The Sumerian king lists call the land from which the invaders came Gutium, a land in the mountains northeast of Mesopotamia. In the legend of Naram Sin, they are called Uman Manda, possibly hordes of Far, strong brothers, who came from camps in the dwelling of Enlil, situated in the mountain land whose city the gods had built. Verses in the text suggest that they were descendants of soldiers who had accompanied Enmerkar on his distant travels, who slew their host and were punished by Utu Shamash to remain in exile. Now tribes great in number, led by 7 chieftain brothers, they were commanded by Enlil to overrun Mesopotamia and hurl themselves against the people who in Nippur had killed. For a while, feeble successors to Naram Sin attempted to maintain a central rule as the hordes began to overrun city after city. The confused situation is described in the Sumerian king lists with the statement, "Who was king? Who was not king? Was Agigi king? Was Nanum king? Was Imi king? Was Elulu king?" In the end, the Gutians seized the control of the whole of Sumer and Akkad. Kingship by the hordes of Gutium was carried off. For 91 years and 40 days, the Gutians held sway over Mesopotamia. No new capital is named for them, and it appears that Lagash, the only Sumerian city to escape despoiling by the invaders, served as their headquarters. From his seat in Lagash, Ninurta undertook the slow process of restoring the country's agriculture, and primarily the irrigation system that collapsed following the Ur-Ra Marduk incident. It was a chapter in Sumerian history that can best be called the Era of Ninurta. The focal point of that era was Lagash, a city whose beginnings were as a sacred precinct, the Gersu, for Ninurta and his divine black bird. But as the turmoil of human and divine ambitions grew, Ninurta decided to convert Lagash into a major Sumerian center, the principal abode for himself and his spouse, Bau Gula, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 85, where his ideas of law and order and his ideals of morality and justice could be practiced. To assist in these tasks, Ninurta appointed in Lagash human viceroys and charged them with the administration and defense of the city-state. The history of Lagash, a site nowadays called Tello, records a dynasty whose reign, uninterrupted for half a millennium, began 3 centuries before the rise of Sargon, an island of armed stability in an increasingly violent environment. Lagash was also a great center of Sumerian culture. While Sumer's religious holidays emanated from Nippur, Lagash originated traditions of festivals tied to an agricultural calendar, such as the Festival of First Fruits. Its scribes and scholars perfected the Sumerian language, and its rulers, to whom Ninurta granted the title Righteous Governor, were sworn to a code of justice and morality. Prominent among the very first rulers of the long dynasty of Lagash was one named Ur-Nanshi. More than 50 of his inscriptions were found in the ruins of Lagash. They record the bringing of building materials for the Gersu, including special timbers from Tilmun for the temple's furnishings. They also describe extensive irrigation works, the digging of canals, and the raising of dikes. On one of his tablets, Ur-Nanshi is depicted heading a construction team, not loath to do some manual work himself, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 86. The 40 known viceroys who followed him left a written record of achievements in agriculture, construction, social legislation, and ethical reforms, material and moral achievements that would make any government proud. But Lagash had escaped the ravages of the turbulent years of Sargon and Naram-Sin, not only because it was the cult center of Ninurta, but also, and primarily, because of the military prowess of its people. As Enlil's foremost warrior, Ninurta made sure that those selected by him to govern Lagash should be militarily proficient. One, named Ianatum, whose inscriptions and stela have been found, was a master tactician and victorious general. The stela show him riding a war chariot, a military vehicle whose introduction has been customarily attributed to later times. They also show his helmeted troops in tight formations, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 87. Commenting on this, Maurice Lambert wrote that the infantry of spearmen, protected by shield-bearers, gave the army of Lagash a defense most solid and an attack most rapid and versatile. The resulting victories of Ianatum even impressed Inanna Ishtar, so much so that she had fallen in love with him. And because she loved Ianatum, kingship over Kish she gave him, in addition to the governorship of Lagash. With this, Ianatum became the Lugal, great man of Sumer, and holding the land in a military grip, he made law and order prevail. Ironically, the chaotic period that had preceded Sargon of Agada found in Lagash not a strong military leader, but a social reformer named Urukagina. He devoted his efforts to a moral revival and to the introduction of laws based on fairness and justice, rather than on a crime-punishment concept. Under him, Lagash proved too weak to maintain law and order in the land. His weakness enabled Inanna to bring the ambitious Lugal Zagizi of Uma to Erech, in an attempt to restore her countrywide dominion. but the failings of Lugal Zaghizi led, as we have already described, to his downfall by the hand of Inanna's new choice, Sargon. Throughout the period of the primacy of Agada, governorship continued uninterrupted in Lagash. Even the great Sargon skirted Lagash and left it intact. It escaped destruction and occupation throughout the upheavals of Naram Sin, primarily because it was a formidable military stronghold, fortified and refortified, to withstand all attacks. We learn from an inscription by Urbau, the viceroy at Lagash at the time of the Naram Sin upheavals, that he was instructed by Ninurta to reinforce the walls of the Gursu and to strengthen the enclosure of the Imdugud aircraft. Urbau compacted the soil to be as stone, fired clay to be as metal, and at the Imdugud's platform replaced the old soil with a new foundation, strengthened with huge timber beams and stones imported from afar. When the Gutians left Mesopotamia circa 2160 BC, Lagash burst into new bloom and produced some of Sumer's most enlightened and best-known rulers. Of these, one of the best-known from his long inscriptions and many statues was Gudea, who reigned during the 22nd century BC. His was a time of peace and prosperity. His records speak not of armies and wars, but of trade and reconstruction. He crowned his activities with the building of a new magnificent temple for Ninurta in a vastly enlarged Gursu. According to Gudea's inscriptions, the Lord of Gursu appeared unto him in a vision, standing beside his divine black bird. The god expressed to him the wish that a new Ininu, House of 50, Ninurta's numerical rank, be built by Gudea. Gudea was given two sets of divine instructions, one from a goddess, who in one hand held the tablet of the favorable Star of Heavens, and with the other held a holy stylus, with which she indicated to Gudea the favorable planet in whose direction the temple should be oriented. The other set of instructions came from a god whom Gudea did not recognize, and who turned out to have been Ningishzida. He handed to Gudea a tablet made of precious stone, the plan of a temple it contained. One of Gudea's statues depicts him seated with this tablet on his knees, the divine stylus beside it, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 88. Gudea admits that he needed the help of diviners and searchers of secrets to understand the temple plan. It was, as modern researchers have found, an ingenious 1-in-7 architectural plan for the construction of a ziggurat as a 7-stage pyramid. The structure contained a strongly reinforced platform for the landing of Ninurta's airborne vehicle. The participation of Ningishzida in the planning of the Ininu carried a significance that went beyond mere architectural assistance, as evidenced by the fact that the Gursu included a special shrine for this god. Associated with healing and magical powers, Ningishzida, a son of Enki, was deemed in Sumerian inscriptions to have known how to secure the foundations of temples. He was the great god who held the plans. As we have already suggested, Ningishzida was none other than Thoth, the Egyptian god of magical powers who was appointed guardian of the secret plans of the pyramids of Giza. Ninurta, it will be recalled, had carried off with him some of the stones from within the Great Pyramid when the Pyramid Wars ended. Now, with the thwarted efforts of Inanna and then Marduk to lord over gods and men, Ninurta wished to reaffirm his rank of 50 by the erection of a step pyramid for himself at Lagash, an edifice to be known as the House of 50. It was for that reason, we believe, that Ninurta invited Ningishzida, Thoth, to come to Mesopotamia, to design for him a pyramid that could be built and raised high, not with massive stone blocks as in Egypt, but with the humble clay bricks of Mesopotamia. The stay of Ningishzida in Sumer and his collaboration there with Ninurta were commemorated not only in shrines to that visiting god, but also in numerous artistic depictions, some of which were discovered during the 60 years of archaeological work at Tello. One of these, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 89A, combined the emblem of Ninurta's divine bird with the serpents of Ningish Zeta. Another, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 89B, depicted Ninurta as an Egyptian sphinx. The time of Gudea and the Ninurta-Ningish-Zeta collaboration coincides with the so-called First Intermediate Period in Egypt, when the kings of the 9th and 10th dynasties abandoned the worship of Osiris and Horus and moved the capital from Memphis to a city the Greeks later called Heracleopolis. The departure of Thoth from Egypt may thus have been an aspect of the upheavals occurring there, as was his subsequent disappearance from Sumer. Ningish Zeta was a god called forth from obscurity in Gudea's time, only to become a phantom god and a mere memory in later Babylonian and Assyrian times. The era of Ninurta in Sumer, lasting through the Gutian invasion and the ensuing period of reconstruction, was only an interlude. A mountain dweller at heart, Ninurta soon began to roam the skies again in his divine black bird, visiting his rugged domains in the northeast and even farther away. Constantly perfecting the martial arts of his highland tribesmen, he gave them mobility through the introduction of cavalry, thereby extending their reach by hundreds and even thousands of miles. He had returned to Mesopotamia at Enlil's call to put an end to the sacrilege perpetrated by Naram-Sin and to the upheavals caused by Inanna. With peace and prosperity restored, Ninurta again absented himself from Sumer, and never one to give up, Inanna seized upon this absence to regain the kingship for Erech. The attempt lasted for a few years, for Anu and Enlil did not condone her deed, but the tale is most fascinating. It reads like an ancient legend of the Excalibur, King Arthur's magical sword, which was embedded in a rock, and could be pulled out only by the one who was chosen for kingship. And it throws light on preceding events, including the incident by which Sargon had offended Marduk. We learn that when kingship was lowered from heaven to begin at Kish, Anu and Enlil established there a pavilion of heaven. In its foundation soil for all days to come, they implanted the Shu-Ha-Daku, an artifact made of alloyed metal whose name translates literally, Supreme Strong Bright Weapon. This divine object was taken to Erech when kingship was transferred there from Kish. It was moved about as kingship moved about, but only when the change was decreed by the great gods. In accordance with this custom, Sargon carried the object to Agada, but Marduk protested because Agada was a brand new city and not one of the cities selected by the great gods of heaven and earth to be royal capitals. The gods who chose Agada, Inanna and her supporters, were in Marduk's opinion rebels, gods who wear unclean clothing. It was to cure this defect that Sargon went to Babylon to the spot where its hollowed soil was located. The idea was to remove some of that soil to a place in front of Agada, there to implant the divine weapon and thus legitimize its presence in Agada. It was in punishment for this, the text states, that Marduk instigated rebellions against Sargon and also inflicted upon him a restlessness. Some take the term to mean insomnia, which led to his death. Further, in the enigmatic text that during the Gutian occupation that followed Naram-Sin's reign, the divine object lay untouched beside the dam works for the waters, because they knew not how to carry out the rules regarding the divine artifact. It was at that time Marduk's contention that the object had to remain in its assigned place without being opened up and not being offered to any god, until the gods who brought the destruction shall make restitution. But when Inanna seized the opportunity to reinstitute kingship in Erech, her chosen king, Utu-Hegal, seized the Shuhadaku in its place of resting. Into his hand he took it, although the end of the restitution has not yet occurred. Unauthorized, Uthu-Hagal raised the weapon against the city he was besieging. As soon as he had done that, he fell dead. The river carried off his sunken body. Ninurta's absences from Sumer and Inanna's abortive attempt to recapture the kingship for Erech indicated to Enlil